Union Pacific Railroad versus Utah State Tax Commission 24093, and the court recognizes counsel for the appellant.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, my name is David Crapo, and I represent Union Pacific Railroad. It is my intent to reserve approximately 3 or 4 minutes for rebuttal, Your Honors. This case is a civil case which asks the court to reaffirm that the reasonable cause standard applies when seeking a preliminary injunction in a matter brought before the Railroad Revitalization and Regulatory Reform Act, also referred to as the 4R Act or the Revised Interstate Commerce Act. It's undisputed by the parties, by the cases that they've cited, that if the 4R Act mandates injunctive relief, then the reasonable cause standard applies. So
does it mandate injunction relief, or is that merely an alternative relief?
Thank you. That's the question. Does the 4R Act mandate relief, or is it merely authorizing it? The United States Supreme Court has set forth the test for making that determination, and we believe the 4R Act meets that test. Now, in the cases of Porter, Tennessee Valley Authority, and the Romero-Barcelo case more recently, the Supreme Court has stated that a congressional act mandates injunctive relief, and I'll quote from Romero-Barcelo, when the purpose and language of the statute limited the remedies available to the district court, and only an injunction could vindicate the objectives of the act. The 4R Act meets that test. Let's look at the purposes and the language of the act. In section 11501B, Congress identified four specific actions by state taxing authorities that it said were unreasonable burdens that discriminate against interstate commerce, and the state may do none of them. And then in the next subsection C, Congress gives jurisdiction to the district courts of the United States to prevent a violation of that subsection B. Now, this circuit has entertained the language and the purpose of the 4R Act on at least 3 or 4 occasions. First in Lennon of 1981, and I'll call that Lennon 1. In that particular case, this court ruled that the 4R Act is specific and clear in authorizing the district court to grant injunctive relief to prevent violations of the 4R Act. Now, granted, that language says authorized, but you read the next paragraph, it says the district court made a mistake. This court says the district court made a mistake when it weighed the damages suffered by the railroad or the counties. And it said it did not exercise the discretion to grant or deny the injunction in light of the purpose of the Interstate Commerce Act. So that case was remanded to the Kansas District Court. Kansas District Court then said, I've got to look at the language and the purpose. And in that particular case, it said, wow, the railroads are asking for a refund of the 1979 taxes that have already been paid, and for the 1980 and subsequent years, an injunction. And the district court said, I see nothing in the 4R Act that allows anything but prospective injunctive relief. The railroads can't get a refund of the previously paid taxes for 79. That decision then gets appealed back to the 10th Circuit, and the 10th Circuit issues decision in Lennon 2 in 1984. And in that decision, the panel reviews the case and says, well, maybe to prevent, to restrain, to terminate, we may have some equity.
And doesn't Lennon 2 just cut to the heart of your position? Because Lennon 2 tells us that, refunds, other remedies are available. We're not just talking about injunctions.
I don't believe so, Your Honor.
Wasn't a refund at issue there? And didn't we say a refund was authorized?
No, the 10th Circuit said it's not authorized. In Lennon 2, Your Honor, the court looked at the language and it said, what does the Supreme Court say? And it looked at the Porter case and the DiMario case. And it said, we must look whether restitution is necessary to effectuate the policy of Section 306, which is the first precursor of the 4R Act. And this court said, let's look at it. The 4R Act was enacted in 1976. It wasn't effective till 1979 to give a 3-year grace period to the states to get their house in order to not have discriminatory taxes. And the 10th Circuit in that case said, based on our reading and what we see that Congress did, restitution is not required or needed to effectuate the purposes of the act, and therefore said the district court was right in prohibiting a refund. No refund was allowed in that case, Your Honor. Then the next time the 10th Circuit entertains a 4R Act is 1999, which is Union Pacific versus Utah. And the challenge was, is the 4R Act a viable action of Congress under the 14th Amendment to Section 5, or did Congress go too far to impinge on the sovereignty of the states and its taxing authority? And this court again said, Congress acted in an appropriate manner in creating the 4R Act because it narrowly limited the relief. And it narrowly limited the relief, and the court says, to permit only injunctive relief. So on at least three occasions, this court has found that the relief is limited under the 4R Act only to injunctive relief, and it can only meet those purposes.
Assuming arguendo that everything you just said is correct, why isn't there at least an ambiguity in the act, assuming that no other equitable remedies are available or legal remedies are available other than an injunction? Why isn't it at least ambiguous on whether or not to obtain any relief under Section 306, there has to be satisfaction of the other equitable remedy of the other equitable factors? After all, the House, when passing a very similar language to the language that was ultimately adopted in Section 306, said specifically that they will also have to make the additional showing that they are entitled to injunctive relief. So why isn't it at least ambiguous, even if we could adopt your interpretation of the word may?
Thank you, Your Honor. First of all, I'll say the House report that was refers to a bill that was not passed. So the report is to a bill that never became law.
The language is almost identical, however.
It's very similar. And if you look at the Senate reports, Your Honor, those Senate reports for the bill that was actually passed did not provide any of that type of language and required the same language of mandatory and prohibitive and did not have that statement that's referenced by the counties in the House report. Moreover, a House report on legislative intent, if you will, cannot trump and cannot circumvent a statute that does not have that language in it. And
unless
the language
is ambiguous, it doesn't need to take precedence over it. And that's why my question is specific about ambiguity. Why isn't the statute at least ambiguous on the need to satisfy the other equitable?
Right. Your Honor, we don't believe that it's ambiguous because the language of the act itself says in 306 to prevent, to restrain, and to terminate. And it lists four items and it says you can't do any of those. And then it says the only way you can really get the relief that is needed is to prevent this. It didn't say we are going to give the authority to correct, to restore, to grant a refund. When you really look at the 4R Act, you're starting to impinge on state sovereignty and the taxing authority under the Tax Injunction Act. If Congress does not want to go too far because it'll violate the 14th Amendment if it does. And so it doesn't go so far because it says we're going to stop any of these four acts that are identified, but we're not going to tell the state this is the tax rate you have to use or this is how you have to cure it. We're just saying these four items are not allowed. And Congress has spoken to say we have made the decision that this is the policy of the United States to protect the Interstate Commerce Act. Now, if you read Porter and if you also read the language of Romero Barcelo, it says we are in a tripartite system and that Congress, once it makes the policy conclusion that it believes that the Interstate Commerce Act is more important than a discriminatory, unfettered power at the state or locality for tax, that decision and policy has been made and the courts are to enforce it. And each of the cases that the 10th Circuit has had thus far are consistent with that. If you read the subsequent cases of First Western and Fish, they enunciate the same standard that I just shared with the court, but said in First Western, this is a Fair Trade Act or a Securities Act. And they said that particular act of Congress allows for fines and penalties and other remedies. It's available. Same thing for fish. Now, the interesting thing also
about— Are there any other available remedies in this case?
Not that I am aware of, Your Honor. The court has been clear.
So it all gets back to our reading the statute that you're relying on, because you're saying that you can distinguish it from, say, the ESA that was at issue in Hill v. TVA.
Correct.
And so if that is the only option, then you win. That's really it in a nutshell, isn't it?
That is correct. If there is no alternative remedy that will accomplish the purpose, it's mandatory under the test that's identified in Romero-Barcelo and quoted by this court in Fish in footnote 24. And Your Honor, there is no other relief. What would happen if you affirm the district court's ruling? One, you'd be overruling the Lennon cases without an en banc hearing. You'd be causing a split in the circuits of the United States, which
wouldn't we be able to look at the post-Lennon Supreme Court cases and say that in essentially Lennon 1 was overruled by those cases, because they are again looking at the statute and saying unless and until there's no other option for the courts, that is the only way injunction is required and the traditional standards not required.
Your Honor, there probably would be that option. Romero-Barcelo and the Supreme Court cases that came after Lennon set forth the same test that was applied before in Tennessee Valley. And the language that is used in the 4R Act is more restrictive than Tennessee Valley. I mean, Tennessee Valley says you have the relief to stop the destruction of habitat. Here, injunctive relief to stop destruction of habitat. Here, it said Congress says you have the right to prevent discrimination against interstate commerce. It doesn't say you have the right to give a refund. Doesn't say you have a right, federal court, to meddle into the taxing rates, the assessment ratios, or anything else. And when it uses the word may, the district court did not look at the language of the Supreme Court in 1987 in Burlington Northern versus Oklahoma, where it said the word may is just may only be granted if you meet that 5% threshold, and said that just means it's a de minimis test. If you only have a ratio difference of discrimination of 1 or 2%, the whole act doesn't apply to this section. That's what the Supreme Court said. So the district court didn't look at the purpose and didn't look at the subsequent
language. You were citing Burlington?
Burlington Northern versus Oklahoma, 1987, United States Supreme Court. Yeah. Your Honor, we believe the test is clear, and that if the district court is affirmed, it causes a split in all the circuits that are consistent with this circuit. Everyone is consistent. It also would permit refunds, which is something that Congress did not contemplate and is not in the act. We'd ask that you reverse and remand for application of the reasonable cost standard. I'd like to reserve my last minute 50 for rebuttal, Your Honor.
Okay. Thank you, counsel. Paul, let's stop the clock. Judge Briscoe, do you have any additional questions?
No.
Judge Murphy?
No.
All right. We recognize Ms. Romano for your argument.
Hey, please, the court. Thank you, Your Honors. Bridget Romano, appearing on behalf of all of the intervener counties. Mr. Peters is watching this through the YouTube channel. I think what the court needs to focus on is the order that's on appeal.
Ms. Romano, before you get in that, you take the position in your briefing that there's no appellate jurisdiction under 1292A1 relying upon the Carson case. Do you persist in that argument?
Your Honor, I believe that the court can determine whether or not this is a final order subject to appellate review.
Is it your position that we do not have appellate jurisdiction over this because there's no express language in the district court's order?
There is no express language in the district court's order. There was clearly a second bite at the apple. The order was dismissed without prejudice.
So you claim we do not have appellate jurisdiction.
I suggest it's a colorable argument that this court needs to examine its appellate jurisdiction.
Well, okay. You said it's colorable. Is it your argument?
It's an argument that we have advanced. I don't think it's the principal argument, Your Honor.
He also argued that the fact that they tendered or paid the amount not in dispute made this moot. Is that still your position?
I think to the extent that they're asking that, in addition to being able to pay the amount that's not in dispute, that they're asking for an injunction to also bar the collection efforts by either the state or the county, that potentially the relief that they sought through the preliminary injunction was not completely granted to them through their efforts of self-help. Clearly, there have not been any efforts to collect, but I do think that to the extent they asked for two things in the preliminary injunction, they have availed themselves of one. It is potentially a right controversy still for this court.
So you're saying it's moot and therefore we have no jurisdiction?
No, I'm suggesting that to the extent the court believes that their preliminary, even after having availed themselves of the relief of only paying the amount of tax that was not in dispute in their opinion, and it's based upon their opinion of value, that the state or the counties could still attempt to collect the tax that's remaining due, that they asked the trial court to restrain that collection of tax, that part of their request for a preliminary injunction is not moot.
All right, so because your argument, I don't know if it's colorable or your argument, that it's partially moot, then it's not a jurisdictional problem.
No, to the extent it's partially moot, they've gotten half the relief that they asked for, but they have not received all of the relief that they asked for. Returning to where I started, I think that what we need to look at is what Judge Shelby did here. Judge Shelby recognized two decisions from this court, Fish and First Western. And what those decisions do is they reveal that after Romero Barcelo, at least at the preliminary injunction stage, and we're talking about the preliminary injunction stage, it's no longer sufficient to do what the railroad did here. It's no longer sufficient for a plaintiff to point merely to evidence that the defendant engaged in or was about to be engaged in a practice or act that's prohibited by the statute. Romero Barcelo also indicates to this court that a court should not presume that a plaintiff is entitled to an injunction unless there is a direct command or there's language in the statute that by necessary or inescapable reference directs the injunction be entered. The court in Romero Barcelo also, the Supreme Court also made clear that a preliminary injunction is not required in all instances.
Are there any incidents in which anyone under Section 306 has ever received a remedy other than an injunction? Has anybody ever received a refund or restitution or any other remedy other than an injunction?
In the cases that I have read, Your Honor, I'm not familiar with a party receiving something other than an injunction, and the railroad could still receive an injunction, but they could receive an injunction after a full trial on the merits. What we have to look at is this case in context. So the language of the 4R Act suggests that an injunction it authorizes the court to enter an injunction as may be necessary. And I think we need to look at the phrase necessity, which is contextual and not mandatory. And in this case, I don't know that necessity can be determined at the preliminary injunction stage. In this case, we don't have an instance in which the railroad is taxed at a rate higher than comparable commercial and industrial property. And by that I mean, railroad can't say it's taxed at 7% while comparable property is only taxed at 5%. It also can't say that on the face of the assessment, the value of the railroad is discriminatory as compared to the assessed value of comparable commercial and industrial property. And that's because the Utah State Tax Commission, in direct observance of the 4R Act, undergoes a sales ratio study where it determines in consultation with the railroad the value of the comparable commercial and industrial property to be compared to the value of the railroad property.
Why is any of this relevant to the reasons that Judge Shelby gave for denying a preliminary injunction? Judge Shelby didn't base his decision on any of that. He based it on the fact that the plaintiff had not tried to demonstrate any other of the equitable factors for a preliminary injunction.
It's relevant because the court in the Judge Shelby in denying the preliminary injunction request looked at this court's decision in Lennon. It looked at the United States Supreme Court's decision in Romero-Barcello, and then it followed through the decisions that this court has issued in Fishman versus Western and determined that in order to decide whether or not its traditional equitable jurisdiction had been constrained or altered by the 4R Act, the court needed to determine whether or not the 4R Act mandates a preliminary injunction or merely authorizes it. Now, while Judge Shelby...
What about Mr. Crippo's argument on the last page of Burlington Northern versus Oklahoma Tax Commission, where Justice Marshall specifically said that Section 306, all it does is provide stays off a relief, an injunction, if it's de minimis, i.e. the 5%. How do you distinguish that and his reliance on Tennessee Valley Authority, where the court specifically said, even though it's $100 million cost, the Congress has already done the weighing of the environmental damage from the snail darter. And so why hasn't Congress already done the balancing under Section 306 that would require equitable relief if the plaintiff overcomes what Justice Marshall characterized as the de minimis exception to 306?
So I think that we're talking about the same thing. We're looking at it, at the different use of the word may. So the de minimis standard is whether or not the discrimination exceeds the 5% threshold. So if the discrimination is somewhere in the 1, 2, or 3, or 4% ratio, there is no relief available under the 4R Act. You have to have 5% or more. But if we go back to the original language of Section 306, which Congress has indicated is still operative in as much as the recodifications do not change the original intent of Section 306, the language used there is as may be necessary. And I think that's the word may that this court should be looking at. There is nothing on the face of Section 306 that suggests a court should abandon all traditional equitable principles. That's what Judge Shelby was looking at, is whether or not there's sufficient language in Section 306 that is read now through the context of Romero-Barcello, Fish, and First Western, if there's sufficient language that would direct the court to abandon those traditional equitable principles. There's nothing on the face of Section 306 that directs a court to grant an injunction based solely upon a showing of reasonable cause. In fact, in First Western, this court made specific point to say that the reasonable cause standard lacks vitality after Romero-Barcello. Instead, the language of Section 306 that the court needs to be looking at is whether or not the grant of injunction relief may be necessary to prevent, restrain, or terminate a 4R Act violation. I think necessity is contextual. And in this case, it's contextual because what the railroad is asking the court to consider is whether or not it's entitled to preliminary injunctive relief based upon the railroad's opinion of its value alone. It's already been, it's subject to the same tax rate. The Utah State Tax Commission has already reduced the assessed value of the railroad by 13% to make sure that in the assessing entity's determination, there is not even de minimis, there is no discrimination between the comparable commercial and industrial property.
So at the end of the trial on the merits, if the court concludes there is a 6% differential between the assessed value of the railroad property versus other properties, in survives the threshold under Section 306, you're saying that the Judge Shelby then could decide to say, well, I'm still giving a defense verdict because I'm going to decide that I, Judge Shelby, I'm going to weigh the factors and think it just is not appropriate to do this to prevent a violation of Section 306. So I'm going to not grant relief. Can he do that?
I think he could. I don't believe that if he found that there was discrimination of 5% or more, I don't think he could refuse to grant relief. he would be able to find there is a 406 violation and the railroad is entitled to relief, and the relief would be equitable in nature.
And one of your two arguments, now one of your arguments is that there are other remedies like refunds, et cetera, that you were arguing to Judge Briscoe a moment ago in your brief. I thought you were arguing that even if there were no other remedies available, that there is a balancing that the court would need to undertake, even if an injunction were the only available remedy. And it sounds like you're not arguing that. Maybe I misread you.
I think if the court ultimately finds their discrimination and finds violation of the act, clearly the court has jurisdiction to remedy that. Just because a court determined that in one instance restitution was not required is not the same thing as saying restitution may never be granted. In the exercise of traditional equitable authority and equitable jurisdiction, Judge Shelby could craft a remedy for the railroad. Just simply because he was not able to, on the reasonable cause showing alone, to grant a preliminary injunction does not mean if, for example, this court were to determine that there's some vestige of the reasonable cause standard that still exists and remand it to Judge Shelby to reconsider in light of the remaining factors of the traditional four-factor test, he could still determine that a preliminary injunction is required and enter it. He could determine that at that stage, he couldn't, that a preliminary injunction was not warranted, however, still adjudicate the case on the merits. He could do what the district court in Virginia did in the CSX versus Forrest case that we cited in our brief, which was to give specific weight to the irreparable harm prong, saying that Congress clearly passed the 4R Act to guard against discrimination. And to that extent, the existence and the purpose of the act should forgive the railroad for meeting the irreparable prong harm, but should not forgive the railroad from having to satisfy the remaining three factors to show it had a reasonable likelihood of success, to balance the harm to the railroad.
I don't know if you're still answering my question, but my question was not about a preliminary injunction. It was about a permanent injunction. At the end of a trial on the merits, maybe you answered my question, but I'm not sure. Forget a preliminary injunction. At a trial on the merits for a permanent injunction, I think I understood you to say that Judge Shelby could not say, I am not going to grant you a permanent injunction if you survive the 5% threshold.
Correct. I think if a violation of the act is found, the court would have to remedy the violation of the act. What I read Romero-Barcello to say, because it is brought in the context of a preliminary injunction, is that the court didn't have to grant a preliminary injunction at that stage. But if the case was ultimately satisfied following a trial on the merits, the court would have to abide by the language of Congress and the direction to remedy the violation of the act through an equitable remedy. The devil is in the details, Your Honor. Clearly, the court, if it decided at the preliminary injunction stage that it wanted to craft something that was different than a preliminary injunction, it could do so. We've seen the district court in Virginia do that in the CSX versus Forrest case. But I don't think that after Fish, after First Western, in adherence to Romero-Barcello, that the court can necessarily allow the railroad to rest on the reasonable cause standard alone. It can show reasonable cause, but in the absence of mandatory language, and as may be necessary, may in some context be mandatory, but it may require a showing more akin to an evidentiary hearing. I do think that's the lesson that we take from the Romero-Barcello line of cases. And I see my time is up. Does anybody else have any questions?
Thank you, Judge Briscoe. Do you have any questions?
No, I don't.
Judge Murphy?
No.
All right, the court recognizes the plaintiff for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd like to just cover a couple of items. As to the mootness question that was raised, the county said that we've received part of the relief we requested. That's simply not true. We never requested relief from the undisputed taxes, only the disputed taxes. And so we are still subject to penalties, interest, tax liens, collection matters. And as the CSX transport case ruled in the Fourth Circuit, that doesn't moot this on the very exact issue that we've got here. I'd like to come back to the Romero-Barcello and whether that overturns Lennon. And I said that could be something the court might be able to say. I'd like to correct that some. Romero Barcelo did not overturn anything for the 4R Act. Romero Barcelo dealt with the Federal Water Pollution Control Act, and it merely enunciated the same standard that's been in place since Porter and Tennessee Valley. If this court wants to overturn Lennon, it really needs to apply that to the 4R Act and make an express ruling the 4R Act is merely authorizing, not mandating. We believe that would require an en banc proceeding.
Could you help us with the initial ruling, the Lennon ruling, and explain the support that the court had at that time for its ruling?
Yes.
I think it cited one Supreme Court case, I believe.
Yes. Lennon in 1981 was relying upon the plain language of the 4R Act, didn't rely on Romero Barcelo because that came out the succeeding year. But it clearly had Tennessee Valley Authority, clearly had Porter, clearly had Hecht, and clearly had DiMario, all which enunciated the same standard. And I think the final thing I'd like to say is that weighing between granting an injunction or not an injunction, if you get to that permanent injunction phase, that's not discretionary. You have to either enforce or not enforce. The court is required to enforce the act. And the language in the 4R Act is similar to Tennessee Valley. You may use what is necessary to do what? To prevent what Congress has decided is important. We'd ask you to reverse and remand, Your Honors.
Judge Briscoe, do you have any additional questions?
I do. The case that I was referring to that Lennon 1 relied on, that's the case I wanted you to speak to. And it is Texas Pacific Railroad Company, that case, that is the only case that is cited in Lennon 1. And how does that help us in our case, looking at Lennon 1, which apparently it is your position that it should stand? And I'm just concerned about the support that the court had to make that ruling.
Thank you, Your Honor. There was a clear ruling by the 10th Circuit, which said under the 4R Act, you use a reasonable cost standard. And the court, this court, looked at the language and said it's clear and specific that it authorizes. Now, if this court wants to say we only looked at authorized because of the case you referred to, Your Honor, it doesn't rely on Romero Barcelo, which came out after. So you could in that.
Well, it relied on what I'm looking at. I think the case that they cite was a permanent injunction case after hearing of evidence on the merits.
Correct. I don't believe.
After they had that information in that case, they based their decision in Lennon on that decision. In part, I appreciate that, of course, had to look at the statute.
Yes, that's correct, Your Honor. That's the way I read it. Of course, they had all the other preliminary injunction cases from Tennessee Valley, which had been issued before, as well as Porter that had been issued before. I guess I just call your attention to Lennon 2, which is consistent with Lennon 1 and is a post Romero Barcelo, as well as Michael, which we've cited.
Does it say restitution is not available ever, or just not available in that case because of the way it was tried?
In Lennon 2, of course, it would be tried on the facts that were presented to it. And in that case, in Lennon 2, they said restitution is not available, and that the district court was correct in saying that you could not grant refunds for 1979 because it was not contemplated to be necessary to effectuate the purposes of the act.
Thank you.
Judge Murphy, do you have any questions?
No.
All right, thank you, counsel. This matter will be submitted.